Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am Jack Pelling.
And I am Robin Allen.
And today we've got an unbelievable guest on the show. We're going to be chatting a little bit later on to the writer and screenwriter and all-round great guy, John Ronson, which is really exciting. He's a massive Beatles fan and got lots of interesting things to talk about, including, well, his personal Beatles, his formative memories. We talk a bit about Paul is Dead. We talk a bit about, you know, conspiracy theories in general. And, yeah, as fascinating stuff as you would expect.
There are so many interesting things we could have talked about with John Ronson. Obviously, he wanted to talk about Paul is Dead and the kind of the way that seemed to pave the way for a lot of conspiracy thinking and things. But then there was also a way we could have talked about, you know, John Lennon, his kind of complex legacy as well in terms of his writing about, you know, public shaming, etc. And then, you know, he's obviously written about outsider art as well. So we ended up talking about outsider art a lot, which isn't very Beatlesy, admittedly, but it was a very interesting chat. So, yeah, it was good to have a kind of quite rambly chat with him.
Yeah, I mean, we could have talked for hours, and there is one of the great rock and roll anecdotes in there towards the end as well. So look out for that. But before we get on with the show, how's your week been, Robin? All good?
It's been pretty good, yeah. This week, I sort of took a deep dive into Strawberry Fields Forever.
Yeah.
Because you remember in May Martin, I was saying, like, I never worked it out on the guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
So this week I worked it out on the guitar. And it's mad. I've got my guitar here.
Please.
So it's really interesting because, sorry, I feel like David Brent now.
Yeah.
So I listened back to the kind of the very first demo, which is on Anthology 2. And he's playing it quite like a finger-picking song, which is really, really interesting because it sounds kind of much more folky.
Yeah.
And he plays it kind of with these chords, like, living is easy with eyes closed, like this. And then when it got into the studio, it's kind of Paul came up with the Mellotron arrangement and it went much more kind of major 7-y. Living is easy with eyes closed. You know, very different feel.
Yeah, completely different.
Yeah.
Because I always forget that it's written on guitar, and then when you play it like that, that makes perfect sense, because it doesn't, when you think about, and it's a slightly different key as well, because it's been sort of sped up and
I'm playing
down.
In D, because I've got, my voice is extremely limited, but I think he wrote it in C, and then it was might have been played in A, but then by the time it was very sped, it would change to A sharp or something.
Yeah, I think it's quite close to F, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or maybe that's the way that it was originally played.
If you look at the Wikipedia page, there's a very interesting thing, because it's his most unorthodox song musically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of hard, one of those ones where it's hard to work out what is the home key, because kind of as the lyrics suggest, you kind of do get a bit lost in the melodic world of it and everything. But the mad thing about the chords as well, working out the chords, is it's the... Strawberry Fields, and then it goes to this chord, which is like you're singing a G over an F sharp seventh, which is so dissonant, it's insane. It's actually hard to sing it.
Way. I mean, such a departure as well from what is relatively like harmonically conservative.
Yeah.
In Rub Soul and
definitely.
And
I mean,
and stuff.
It's so similar thematically to In My Life, but it's so such a kind of progression melodically and kind of. The great thing about it as well is I was thinking about how, you know, I read that quote last week from Electric Eden about the idea that Strawberry Field kind of birthed loads of distinct genres.
Mm.
And one of the kind of genres I think I can hear in Strawberry Fields is ambient. Because when I listen to Strawberry Fields, I find it so kind of atmospheric that I kind of... It's one of those songs you almost forget you're listening to because you get so immersed in that world. And particularly in the first minute or so, which is, you know, the original version before it goes into the more drum-based version, it's yeah. such a kind of tranquil zone that you almost kind of drift off, and it has almost the effect of ambient music where you kind of don't, you know, you're listening and not listening at the same time.
Yeah.
Something.
Well,
know.
That's what I love. Then you sort of get jolted awake by those cacophonous drum fills.
Yeah, it kind of needs to
change
be
your tempo. And
yeah, it was such an incredible artistic decision to make that edit, because it's like this subtle kind of, well, it's not subtle if you know about it, but I mean, did you notice it before you read about it, that edit between the two takes?
I noticed it definitely from the pitch rather than like right. noticing the splicing or whatever.
Yeah.
I think probably with being young and playing along to it on the guitar and then wondering why I was suddenly out of tune.
Yeah, it does go, it does drift a bit.
Yeah.
But it's so Lennon, the first way you play it, that.
Yeah.
Those slightly desperate minor chords that aren't really.
Yeah, it's quite
key.
Bob Dylan-y as well.
Yes,
actually.
Yeah, definitely.
Not a million miles away from Lay Lady Lay or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, 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 yeah. It's just been a reminder of how kind of powerful that song is, really. Working it out and seeing those kind of mad chords and things, it's just been, I've really enjoyed that this week.
Yeah, well, I think it is. We've had a few people sort of say what their quintessential Beatles song is, if such a thing exists, which it definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
But if I had a gun to my head, I think Strawberry Fields would be the one.
Yeah, yeah.
And we recorded our first IRL podcast this week, which was really good fun.
Yes, that was brilliant.
I properly got round the table and recorded a great episode, which will be coming soon, so that was nice.
A few cans
and then we
were
went
drunk.
To the pub afterwards and they played a bit of Beatles in the pub.
Yeah, Ballad of John and Yoko.
Yeah, so
was,
there you go.
That was good.
We're being followed around by it. We got some lovely correspondence this week, as usual, so thank you so much for writing in and sharing some of your personal Beatles stories with us. You can get in touch with the show by emailing me, jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. But, yeah, we just thought we'd read up a couple of really nice ones, and I'm really sorry to everyone that emailed in that we don't have time, but we got to crack on with the show. But a guy called Alex Blackburn wrote in with a nice email saying he's been really enjoying the pod. And there's been a lot of chat about Beatles solo work, and he just wondered if he'd come across the Black Album from the film Boyhood. Yes, I have. It's one of my favourite films of recent years. And there is a fantastic bit in it, if you have seen that film, where Ethan Hawke presents his son. If you don't know the sort of premise of Richard Linklater's Boyhood, it's sort of filmed over a decade and a half, and you see all the actors, child actors, sort of age in real time and stuff. And there's a very touching moment where Ethan Hawke's character gives his son Mason a sort of handmade copy of the Black Album, which is basically a compilation of all of the best Beatles solo stuff to create one more record that, you know, what would have the record after Abbey Road might have sounded like.
Yeah.
And he's highlighted one particular passage in there in one of the letters that I think this whole thing was based on an actual letter that Ethan Hawke wrote to his real daughter, and he describes the inter-Beatle relationship in a brilliant way here. He says, there's this thing that happens when you listen to too much of the solo stuff separately. Too much Lennon, suddenly there's a little too much self-involvement in the room. Too much Paul, and it can become sentimental, let's face it, borderline goofy. Too much George, I mean, we all have a spiritual side, but that's only interesting for about 6 minutes, you know? Ringo, he's funny, irreverent and cool, but he can't sing. He had a bunch of hits in the 70s, even more than Lennon, but you aren't going to go home and crank up a Ringo Starr album start to finish. You're just not going to do it. When you mix up their work, though, when you put them side by side and let them flow, they elevate each other and you start to hear it. The Beatles.
That's brilliant. Is there actually a track listing for the Black Album then? Or is it?
There is, yeah. So I think he wrote an article on BuzzFeed shortly after it came out, which we'll post in the description
nice.
If you want to read it.
Does it have junk on it? It must have junk on it.
Well, my only sort of qualm with that is that it's a four-disc album.
Oh, right.
Which
right.
I think is that's cheating in the exercise cheating. Of yeah, picking, yeah. you know. I mean, I suppose you're allowed a double album, but
yeah.
four CDs is too much.
Yeah, come on.
Also, you're thinking of a lot of Ringo stuff that you definitely wouldn't put on. But thank you very much for sending that in. Cheers.
I've got a really nice email here, which is from Ed Williams. And he said, "Dear Jack and Robin, just wanted to email you to say how fantastic the podcast is and how much I'm enjoying it." I also wanted to share a personal Beatles story with you about a missed opportunity. My father-in-law, Robert, worked for the BBC as a camera operator for about 40 years. In the early 60s, as a young man, he went into work on his day off and ended up sitting in one of the studios watching a band rehearse, but had no idea who they were. Obviously, it was the Beatles, and to this day, I'm still unsure how he didn't know it was them. What so many people would have given to have been in his position. When he spoke to his wife, Jenny, later that day, she realised who it was and was fairly annoyed that he hadn't at least tried to get their autographs. This came up in his Father of the Bride speech many years later when I got married to his daughter, Vicky, with a spurious link to my own time in a heavily heavily Beatles-influenced band while studying in Liverpool, where we did play at the Cavern on a couple of occasions.
Cool.
That's really nice. Keep up the good work, he says. So, yeah, thanks very much, Ed. That's a really lovely... that's great. My dad was once on a train with the Hollies. But he was too shy to say anything, yeah.
Oh, that's quite cool. Yeah, thank you very much to the other people that we don't have time to read out. We got lovely emails from Adam and Ian and David. We really appreciate them, and we do read them all and try and get back to everyone. But obviously, we're a bit pushed for time, and people want to hear John Ronson, so we'll crack on with the show. So you can follow the show on social media, as always, at Personal Beatles. We're on Facebook and Twitter, on Instagram. And if you enjoy the show, please do give us a nice 5-star rating, as lots of kind people have done this week. We really appreciate it, and it really helps grow the audience and helps people find the show. So if you listen on Apple Podcasts or Acast, that is much appreciated. And if you do want to give us something back and help support the show and help us cover some of the costs of it, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate and give whatever you can. And we do have a couple more, I think literally a couple more of our very snazzy Beatles mugs left. So if you'd like one of them, do message us on one of our social media accounts and we'll let you know how we can get one over to you.
Enjoy the show.
So this week, Robin and I are absolutely delighted to have joining us writer and screenwriter and raconteur and one of my heroes, actually, John Ronson.
Hello.
Hello.
How's it going, John?
Raconteur sets the bar high when it comes to free form podcast conversations. Yeah. But I'll do my best. How are you both doing?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, really good, thank you. Yeah. How's your lockdown been?
Fine. I mean, I'm just, you know, I feel guiltily fortunate. We're in a little village in upstate New York, and so it really hasn't been a burden for us, and which means, you know, I forget how much of a huge burden it is for so many people. We're very lucky.
You're a big Beatles fan, and I saw you reading Craig Brown's new book the other day, which is absolutely fantastic.
I have it right here. Yeah, I've been spending much of the lockdown reading Craig Brown's wonderful book.
It's brilliant. It's great. I love how short the chapters are. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just great. You can just really whiz through it. It's so entertaining. I love the brilliant chapter about Paul just randomly ending up in some pub and playing Lady Madonna to all the people there. Have you read that bit?
I'm on page 580 of... I don't think of 642. I'm not sure that Paul's done that yet.
Okay.
How far have I got? Well, he's just... I adore the book with one caveat, which is I don't love his relentlessly withering portrayal of Yoko.
Right, yeah.
And I'm at one of those chunks right now where Yoko's being kind of infantilized and mercilessly mocked. Everybody else in the book comes over with such humanity.
Yeah.
And Yoko, even John, but Yoko... he's just decided he just thinks she's an idiot.
I thought we'd kind of moved past that kind of culturally to, you know, because it was such a thing at the time. But like, Yoko Ono's so well respected now, you know.
Yeah, I think that's the book's one error. Otherwise, I just adore it. It's the rabbit holes that he goes down that he then encourages you to go down, like the Singing Nun and Jimmy Nichol and the old guy in the Hey Jude video who I had never noticed until now, and now you can't unsee him. It's like that advert with the gorilla and the basketball players. Now the Hey Jude video is only about the old guy.
It's like the you know, the Young Ones, the Extra Housemate in The Young Ones. Have you, do you know that?
There's head sticking out the bed.
Once you notice her, she's just like there all the time. It's really, that's great.
That's right.
And did you read the Paul is Dead chapter then?
I've just got past the Paul is Dead chapter. I just thought it was fascinating. Well, I think that it sort of encapsulates why people get so obsessed with the Beatles. My very first, in preparation for this, I was reminiscing about my earliest encounters with the Beatles. And my very earliest encounter, I must have been 3 or 4 years old, and the Beatles songbook had just come out. And I don't know if you know, at the back of the Beatles songbook are all these sort of pop art representations of different Beatles songs. I'm not sure who the artist is, but anyway, for somehow, probably because of my mother telling me that all of these people had been murdered because of Beatles songs, and I sort of put two and two together and made five, and I remember being 3 or 4 years old and sitting in the spare room at our house in Cardiff, looking at these pop-art pictures at the back of the Beatles songbook and thinking that it was the pictures that had inspired Charles Manson to kill Sharon Tate. So I was, trying to decipher clues from these pictures. So when I got to the Paul is Dead part, it didn't only remind me of QAnon, it also reminded me of my own 4-year-old self looking for clues in Beatles pictures and songs. And as a result, I think it's probably no surprise that my favourite Beatles album throughout my teenage years was the White Album, again feels like an album of mystery and clues snippets. Mm.
Definitely. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the QAnon thing, because like the Charles Manson conspiracies to do with the White Album are very much based around a religious kind of interpretation of it, that the Beatles are the four horsemen of the apocalypse, etc. And the QAnon's got a kind of, the language they use is kind of quite religious in some ways, maybe.
And in the end, maybe both are just, maybe it's religion, but it's also amateur sleuthery. It's Miss Marple. It's the same as chemtrails and wanting to solve mysteries. Of course, the other QAnon thing is that they think they're doing something incredibly moral and important.
For a British audience that might not be that familiar with QAnon, can you just, like, briefly explain what it is?
Sure. OK, a few years ago, somebody who called themselves Q started posting on message boards claiming to be high up in the Trump administration or high up in intelligence or something, but, you know, high up in American, in the deep state. And this person was basically, their message was that Trump was fighting a cabal of satanic paedophiles. So it incorporates Pizzagate, which was the idea that Hillary Clinton had a secret dungeon where she would abuse children in the basement of a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C. Yeah. But also Epstein, and obviously that part of it's true. And if you look closely, Trump is giving out secret, just like Paul is Dead, you know, just like Beatles giving secret clues that Paul was dead.
What's the reasoning behind why they keep giving clues?
Well, I mean, there's no logic, right? I mean, there's, you know, like if Trump, it's the same thing as to why flag saucers always tend to land in ambiguous ways. like never in cities, right? It's always always someone in the desert.
I read one Paul is Dead thing where they were talking about they wanted to give clues because they wanted to soften the blow that Paul was dead.
With QAnon, It's like if Trump wears a yellow tie at a press conference, that's giving a some message about something.
Right.
It's to do with nautical flags.
Right.
As if Trump would have his map, would have his like nautical flag thing up on the wall and decide to wear a yellow tie for that reason.
Well, so the biggest stretch for me is that Trump could conceivably do something morally great and not go on about it 24 hours a day.
I know, right?
I don't get the impression he could keep a secret that big.
Yeah. I would hazard, by the way, that another reason for the Paul is dead thing, for the reason, it's not just the sleuthery and the religious aspect of it. I wonder whether it's also the fact that, you know, we give the Beatles so much brilliance, like we bestow upon them such brilliance, that we don't like it when they shout something as banal as cranberry sauce. Mm. So we want to play it backwards and hear I Bury Paul, because otherwise it's just a bit kind of shit.
We put them in a place where we are scrutinising them with such intense detail. And like I think we said this before in another episode about the idea that the Beatles' history is kind of like this Stations of the Cross thing where the village fate is kind of takes on this unearthly significance, and all these other events in the Beatles' lifeline take on this incredible significance.
Which is not entirely unjustified.
Yeah,
I'd argue. I mean, they were, you know, they sort of lived up to the hype.
And one of the interesting thing about how Paul is Dead started, and this is in the Craig Brown book, is the idea that someone who worked for the Beatles rang an American college radio station pretending to be Paul.
It predated that.
Okay.
So somebody said, you know, I've got these ideas about Paul.
Right.
And so they were out there, so the rumours were out there a bit already.
Yeah.
And then somebody, I think it was Derek Taylor or somebody said to Paul, you've got to say something.
Yeah.
You've got to like, and Paul was like, oh, I can't be bothered to do that. So then they got somebody in Paul's orbit to pretend to be Paul.
Which is kind of mistake number one if you're kind of dealing with conspiracy theories.
You're really fanning the flames.
Yeah.
I know, right? Yeah. I think Paul was just at his farm in Scotland. He didn't want to be bothered.
Yeah.
I love the when they were actually forced to do the rebuttal a few years later, just because the rumours wouldn't go away, and Derek Taylor released this press release that says, Paul said, I'm alive and well and concerned about the rumours of my death, but if I were dead, I would be the last to know. So he says, Paul refuses to say anything more than that. Even if he appeared in public, it wouldn't do any good. If people want to believe he's dead, then they'll believe it. The truth is not at all persuasive. Once again, the denial was taken as proof positive of a cover-up. That seems quite prescient.
There's another Paul interview where he sort of says on video, oh, you know, if you want to believe that, you can believe it, you know, in this very kind of beaterly way, like believe what you want to believe. And that's also kind of maybe that wasn't the best way to deal with it.
Looking back on it now, the fact that it was so exciting, the whole Paul is Dead stuff, maybe we should have anticipated that kind of way of thinking would end up taking over the whole world.
But I was thinking that, because what were any big conspiracy theories prior to that, the 60s, there must have been some ones, because that was...
Yeah.
It really did seem to kind of pave the way for a lot of the way we think now.
I think you're right. I think it was one of the very big ones. I mean, obviously, JFK, 63, how long did it take, I wonder, for that to become a conspiracy theory? I don't know about that. Yeah, and then Paul is Dead kind of sprung up around 68, didn't it?
Yeah, and then the moon landings the year after.
although I'm sure that the moon landing conspiracy theories were way later. Like,
yes,
I don't remember hearing those conspiracy theories till like the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're right. I think Paul is Dead might be one of the first great sort of international conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and so much more fun than the ones we have to deal with now.
Do you have a favourite one of the Paul is Dead ones?
Let me reacquaint.
While you're looking, my favourite one is the theory that the George Harrison at the end of While My Guitar Gently Weeps is moaning, Paul, Paul, Paul. It's the most out of character thing George Harrison could ever do.
Right. I remember there's a part of Hey Jude, if you play it backwards, it's Paul saying, I'm a phony. I lived 6 blocks away from the Dakota for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've had many, many days. And I've been inside the Dakota.
Wow. Oh, nice.
Yeah. my friend, the human rights lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, he has no money. He's like, I guess in a way, he's like a sort of cult leader in that he has no money. And so he just relies on the kindness of other people.
Wow.
And one of the kindnesses bestowed upon Clive when he's in New York is that a friend of his lets him stay at his place at the Dakota.
Wow.
So I've been inside the Dakota.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah. And my son had a friend who had a really massive apartment in the Dakota and says he saw Yoko at one point in the corridor when he was visiting.
Wow.
Yeah. It's quite a spooky sort of place for me. I remember going to visit it and just feeling a little bit like a sort of disaster tourist. Why am I here? It's a bit horrible.
Yes, I think you're right about that.
I've always found it quite fascinating that John Lennon moved to New York, to the biggest, most bustling city in the world, to sort of recapture his anonymity. So as a sort of Englishman, well, a Welshman in New York, is there a different sort of distance that you can keep from general people in New York City that you don't get in London?
Well, I know fewer people in New York City than I do in London. And also, personally speaking, I'm less well-known in New York than I am in London. So I tend to just wander around by myself and sort of lose myself. There is a nice feeling of being just swallowed up in America, just lost in America. It's such a huge place. And I like being unmoored in America.
Yeah.
So the unmooredness of it is part of its appeal, I'd say. Whereas in London, you sort of always know where you are. If I'm wandering around London, someone will usually come up to me like once or twice a day, and so you sort of feel, you're always in your own skin. But in America, you can be anyone and do anything. I suppose you don't. Yeah,
it's interesting where all the Beatles ended up actually, because they're so like quintessential to their character.
Yes,
Ringo in LA with his nasal Californian ans, and
that's right. George was in. Where was that big castle?
He's gardening in Henley-on-Thames.
Henley, that's right.
Park, yeah.
I was going to ask, talking about New York, have you read The Lonely City by Olivia Lang? Have you read that?
I've read that, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great book, because I watched Frank recently, and Olivia Lang in The Lonely City, she wrote it in New York, where she's had the similar feeling of being unmoored, I think, and it's a book about outsider artists, among other things. But people like Henry Darger and people like that, the visual artist.
Okay, no, I don't know him. But certainly when I was writing Frank, I did a big dive into outside of art, but mainly musical, The Shags and Daniel Johnson.
Yeah.
And Captain Beefheart.
Brilliant, yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but The Shags, Frank Zappa said The Shags album was the best album ever made, didn't he? Or the best pop album. He said it was better than The Beatles, didn't he? Something like that.
Yeah.
The link.
Tom Waits was a huge Shags fan. I mean, the Shags story, I will tell your listeners, it's quite a... it's a more horrific story than we want it to be.
Right, yeah.
The story that you want it to be is these sort of feral children who had never heard music... Mm. Suddenly, are told by their father that they have to create that. Their father had had a, they were like a religious family. They lived in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. They weren't allowed to listen to music.
Yeah.
And then their father had a vision from God. Mm. And the vision was that his daughters were going to be the world's biggest girl group.
Mm.
And so he took them out of school and, got them to rehearse 10 hours a day. They couldn't go swimming. They had to rehearse. They just rehearsed and rehearsed until he declared them ready. And then they all went off to a recording studio. This was in Massachusetts, I think. And they recorded their album, Philosophy of the World.
Yeah.
And if you've never heard music and you have to create music from scratch, what will it sound like?
Yeah, it's incredible from that perspective. Because when you first hear it, you think they're playing it wrong, but they're all playing it wrong together.
You know,
and that's what's incredible. A bit like Trout Mask as well. It sounds like that. It's a very tight version of abstraction.
Oh, the rich people want what the poor people got. And the poor people want what the rich people got. And the skinny people want what the fat people got. And the fat people want what the skinny people got.
Yeah, but actually the story's a little darker than that because the controlling and abusive nature of the father is sort of underplayed in the more romantic versions of the story.
Right,
In fact, it was abuse.
Abuse, yeah.
So he's kind of like a Joe Jackson.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson's dad kind of figure as well, maybe.
Yeah.
But there's have you ever been to... There's a brilliant outsider art museum in Lausanne in Switzerland.
Oh, no, I haven't.
It's fantastic. And I went there.
Oh, is it the one with the really bad outsider art?
It might. Some of it's bad and some of it's really good. It's a huge mix. I mean, is there such a thing as bad outsider? I don't know.
there's a picture of a couple of dogs. I'll try and find it.
Okay. There's a brilliant artist. I loved his paintings there. He's called Augustin Lesage. And it reminded me of him because he heard a voice from God that told him to paint.
Uh-huh.
And he paints these enormous, very detailed patterned paintings, and they're always completely symmetrical. And he went into the art shop and asked for, 10 inches of canvas or something. And he did a Spinal Tap and was given, 10 feet or something like that. And so he said, and then he was like, well, that's a message from God too, that they have to be really big. And then so all his paintings are just massive, and they're this kind of like bizarre... almost looks like some kind of weird Where's Wally kind of thing, where it's just your eyes are just kind of so confused by this detail and it's all perfectly symmetrical. It's very beautiful.
But, I'd like to send you the picture of the two dogs, but I don't. Okay. I've just taken a screenshot. Is there a little... Oh, there's a chat box.
But can you describe it for us, the two dogs?
Would you be willing to describe it when I send it to you?
Okay.
Yeah. Just to describe this picture, it looks like a sort of King Charles Cavalier that's got a, like, Liberace's harmonica.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Or a mouth guard, maybe.
Next to some sort of monkey, or is it supposed to be another dog?
It's another dog that looks a little bit like a kind of almond, quite coy. it's not a harmonica the dog's got in its mouth. It's obviously some kind of dog toy.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is it. That's very... Yeah. The dogs have got very intense expressions.
Yeah, it's a very compelling picture.
Yeah, it really is compelling.
Their eyes really follow you around the room.
Yeah. So I've got a question. I've got a question for you. Have any of your guests so far met any Beatles?
Yeah.
Yes, we had Guy Chambers on a couple of weeks ago, who produces and writes all Robbie Williams and stuff. Yeah. Mm. So he talked about going down to Paul's studio when they made a charity record together and sort of telling Paul not to do it like that and do it like that, which sounds terrifying.
Yeah. But, my God.
No, we haven't. Have you ever met a Beatle?
No, I've never met a Beatle. I've met or certainly been in the vicinity of other sort of my great childhood musical heroes. I was in the same room as Bowie once and so on. But no, never a Beatle.
Well, because we talk a lot about whether you would actually want to or whether it would be the worst thing ever. Mm. But you've met my, outside of the Beatles, my childhood musical hero, Randy Newman.
Oh, yeah. I've met Randy Newman a bunch of times, actually.
He is someone that I think... I wouldn't want to meet.
No, he's not. He's great. He's just as you'd want him to be. He's funny and self-deprecating and thoughtful and neurotic and very open, like very sincere. I asked him once why he wrote songs, and he said He said, it's how I judge myself and how I feel better.
Wow.
That's exactly
the kind
why
of sound bite you want.
But also great. It's true. You know, I've long had the eerie thought that every idea and every thought I've ever had has already been had by Randy Newman. I see Randy Newman as my kind of intellectual doppelganger. Like every time I've had an idea for a book or a story, it's like Randy Newman's already done that. Mm. Every time I've made a self-deprecating joke or my book about public shaming. Mm. So you've been publicly shamed. Justine Sacco's story, the AIDS tweet woman, is really, that could be a Randy Newman song.
Yeah. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Talking about public shaming book, I saw on Twitter you were kind of you were defending it the other night. Because has it become a kind of touchstone for the alt-right or people complaining about...
I wasn't defending the book. A bunch of the people who liked the book the most were sort of free speech centrists, the kind of people who signed that Harper's letter.
Right, okay,
And whilst as people, I like them very much and agree with some of the things that they write... Mm. I just think it's kind of nuts for a New York Times columnist with a big, loud voice, an agent provocateur, contrarian columnist, is just a very different kettle of fish to the stuff that I was writing about in my book, which is a private individual who tells a silly joke that gets misconstrued and then their life is destroyed and it's a miscarriage of justice. I'm old enough to remember life, before the internet. And before the internet, contrarian columnists were fucking yelled at. This isn't a new phenomenon. And it's particularly in Britain, where the adversarial system is so vicious. I mean, I'm not a fan of it. But it bugs me that when they're criticised, even if they're being screamed at by thousands of people... Mm. Even if it's still a different kettle of fish to the kind of things I was writing about in my book. And it annoyed me a little that they were trying to equate the two.
Do you think someone like John Lennon is untouchable when it comes to things like cancel culture? Because he's got some pretty sort of, maybe not skeletons, but, there's some more unpleasant stuff. That went on in terms of his misogyny and, domestic violence. And things
yes,
like that.
Yeah, you're right. Has anyone gone there? Has anyone tried to...
Well, this is what we were sort of talking about the other day, that it seems like he's managed to get a... Well, I mean, it helps if you've been dead for 40 years, but he's got a bit of a free pass in those things. And he did sort of redeem himself and stuff, but you wonder whether he would ever have been given the chance to turn from... the person that he wrote Run For Your Life to the person who wrote, Women is the N-word of the world. Or whatever.
Yeah. You know, part of the thing that might have saved John Lennon was that the book where all of those things were first aired was the Albert Goldman book, right? The Lives of John Lennon, which was a terrible book. Mm. And, Goldman came over, terribly, a little bit like, the way Craig Brown... depicts Yoko in his otherwise wonderful book. Goldman just portrays John Lennon as the worst human being who ever lived. So the fact that the messenger was so bad probably helped. Probably helped John Lennon.
How do you think John Lennon, what do you think a kind of a character he would be now? Because I do you know, are you aware Sean Lennon has become slightly moved into this territory we talked about, where he's talking about worrying about free speech. I think he might be a fan of Jordan Peterson, so don't quote me on that. But I have a theory that John Lennon might have gone kind of quite full-blown Alex Jones style kind of.
I think that's not an unreasonable supposition. I mean, I don't think he would have been a fan of cancel culture and Twitter shamings and so on. Has Paul ever commented, or Ringo?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. There was, I mean, they've kind of defended him and said that it wasn't all, rosy and stuff, and that he did have a slightly more sort of tortured side to his character. But the general consensus that was that by the sort of mid-70s, after his sort of Dakota building bread baking days, that he had sort of let go of a lot of the reasons
anger.
Why he was so sort of contorted by anger, and that he was incredibly mellow and that made up with everyone kind of before he died, which made it all the more kind of tragic, really.
Yes. I mean, the fact that he, stayed home for how many years shows that he needed, presumably, that to happen. He was probably in a real state when the Beatles split up. Yeah, he was taking heroin. Everything had been lost. Him and Paul hated each other, and he was the most famous person in the world. And, he was probably in a real state. I can completely understand why he'd want to just stay home and bake bread for several years. When I was younger, I would have thought, and in fact, I remember myself thinking, why would John Lennon want to squander all the adventures he could have had for just staying in and breaking bread? That's not a mystery to me anymore. I can eat sleep, spend the rest of my life never leaving these halls.
Were you always a John person when you grew up as a young Beatle fan, or did you have a sort of journey around the four of them?
No, I think I was always a John person and George. I was a John and George person. However, because Craig Brown devotes so much time in his book to Hey Jude, so much time that I think he's basically saying Hey Jude was the Everest peak of the Beatles. I went back and watched Hey Jude a few times recently, and I think I might agree with Craig Brown. And I think maybe it was a Paul song which epitomises the Beatles at their absolute best. I think we all, many of us, were into John and George, but actually, maybe we were doing Paul a little bit of a disservice. I think maybe the best Beatles songs might have been Paul songs. Hey Jude, Blackbird,
Let It Be.
Let It Be,
Eleanor
and Rigby. Then what was John? And then John was doing that fucking I Dig a Pony. Although that was really a guess, because I have no idea whether John wrote I Dig a Pony.
No, that's much one of his nonsense songs that was penned off in, half an hour before they had to record it. Yeah. I think his work ethic sort of went down the toilet when he got addicted to heroin, which will happen.
All the cool people want to think of John Lennon's being the best Beatle, but actually maybe if you really go back into it, it was Paul.
I think Paul has really been reassessed in recent years. And one of the things I found interesting about doing this podcast is that I thought it was quite a sort of, liking Paul was like sort of having Roger Moore as your favourite Bond, and it was sort of a bit uncool. But actually, as you get older, you become more and more sort of okay to just be uncool. And
I think the moment that really made me shift was when I was reading the Craig Brown book, is this story about how the Rolling Stones had were having this party for the Beggar's Banquet album, and Paul turned up, and they'd just finished recording Hey Jude that day, so And it was like a listening party for Beggar's Banquet. So when Beggar's Banquet was finished, Paul put on, you know, the new, hey, does anyone want to hear the new Beatles song? and put on Hey Jude. And there's quotes from people who were at the party, I think Marianne Faithfull or whoever, saying, you know, nobody had ever heard the song before. And it was such a moment of us all standing there listening to Hey Jude. So I then went and re-listened to Hey Jude and tried to imagine myself being at that Beggar's Banquet party.
Yeah. Wow.
And thinking, yes, I mean, God, can you imagine hearing this song for the first time in this set of circumstances? And apparently Mick Jagger was really pissed off. He'd felt
it's a bit of a dick move, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a dick move. And Mick Jagger went up to Paul McCartney afterwards and said, you know, so like, oh yeah, what a great, great song. It's like two songs joined together, isn't it? So he was like trying to demean.
There's another great one where I think Bob Dylan has flown over the acetates for What's Going to Be Blonde on Blonde when the Beatles between Rubber Soul and Revolver, and they play him Tomorrow Never Knows. Mm-hmm. And the other people in the room kind of described his face dropping and going a bit sort of ashen.
Right.
And then his comment afterwards was like, I get it, so you don't want to be cute anymore.
Tomorrow Never Knows, that's an example of John being as, you know.
I was thinking because I've been really enjoying Let It Be Naked recently, and not listening to it naked, but, you know, the album Let It Be Naked. And what's so lovely about the later Paul of the Beatles is I think Let It Be is just so beautiful, and Long and Winding Road, because he sounds so vulnerable on those two records, I think. And I think the weird thing is with John and Paul is that they were both quite vulnerable people, maybe, or damaged people slightly. And John obviously disguises it with the sarcasm and aggression, and Paul disguises it by going into whimsy and, you know, parody and stuff. But then on Let It Be, you get a real sense that Paul's actually really revealing himself. You know, maybe that's why it was called Naked or something. But it's so beautiful, the Long and Winding Road. And it's so weird for me as well, because, you know, the first time I heard it, I thought, God, I can't believe this is the Beatles, because the strings are so shit. And then you realise they didn't actually want it to sound that way, because you just assume a song is the way the artist wanted it to sound, you know.
Although across the year, when my son was a baby, he was like such a handful, and the only song that would get him to sleep was Across the Universe. So I have John to thank for that.
That's great. Yeah.
Although quite often it was the Fiona Apple version that got him to sleep.
Still good.
That's a great
I would argue, and many would disagree, that the Fiona Apple version of Across the Universe is a better version than the original, but
definitely better than the Bowie version.
Quite
dodgy. But that's one of the rare Phil Spector ones that I actually do prefer to the Let It Be Naked one, because that song is so sort of dreamy and ethereal that those kind of distant Wallace-hour choirs feel more at home on that record than they do on something like Long and Winding Road, where you can tell that they're working with basically a demo. And going nuts.
By the way, speaking of the Rolling Stones, do you know, I've told this story twice. I told it once on the Marc Maron podcast and once on Twitter. But it's this story about how I ended up nearly dying on Concord with Keith Richards. Do you know this story?
I don't know.
Can I tell the story?
Absolutely. Please do, yeah.
So this was the late 90s, I'd say, and I could probably date it, but I won't. I'll just be not tapping and clicking and a bit boring. But I got a call. I was writing for... This is such a long time ago. This is probably the mid-90s, because I was writing for this men's magazine called Loaded, which I'm slightly embarrassed about. Anyway.
I used to write for Loaded as well. It's not on my CV.
Right, yeah. And so I got a telephone call saying that Chris Evans, the radio presenter, was going to be flown out on a private plane to meet Prince in Minneapolis. And there's a couple of spare seats on the plane. Did I want one? So I was like, yes, yes, I do. And then I got very excited. It's like a Learjet. And it never happened. Chris Evans had some big flouncy falling out with the Prince people and said he wasn't going. So the record company said, you know, OK, the Learjet's fallen through, but we don't want to cancel the whole trip. So we're going to get you all on Concorde. Do you want to go on Concorde to meet Prince? So I said, yes. So I turned up at the airport, Heathrow, and I went up to the Concorde desk and I said, hi, I'm a passenger on Concorde today. And the woman, the BA woman, said, are you the courier? And I said, no, I'm a passenger. And she turned to the woman next to her and said, find out if he's the courier. So I convinced them I wasn't the courier. I promise you that everything I tell you is entirely true. And if any of it's not true, it's just my memory playing tricks on me. So I got on the plane and sat down. And the person came and sat down next to me, my fellow passenger. And I looked over and it was Keith Richards. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm going to have to spend the next 4 hours pretending that I don't know Keith Richards is sitting next to me. Just have to look straight ahead. And Keith Richards poked me in the ribs and we got talking. And at one point, I swear to God, at one point he said, I've done everything, man. So I was talking to Keith, I was like, you know, chatting to Keith Richards, and then everybody got a certificate that said, you know, I've been on Concorde. But I noticed that Liam Neeson either wasn't offered one or brushed it away, because I did notice, you know, they gave me a certificate saying I've been on Concorde, but they didn't give Liam Neeson one, which made me think, as I was sitting there, that they somehow just thought Liam Neeson was, and I was like this sort of twat who would want a certificate. So I was like sitting there kind of slightly, why are they giving me a certificate for not Liam Neeson? Anyway, the plane took off and it reached Mach 2. And there was like a little sign at the front of the cabin that said Mach 2. So lit up, had a thing kind of ripping the floors. And then the plane started like lurching and slowing down and juddering. And it went like way back down to like Mach 1.2 or whatever. And there was that sort of ripple of something. And the captain came on the tannoy, but the tannoy was malfunctioning. So the captain said, you may have noticed that we've fuel leak. And then, like, silence, and then more juddering. And then the captain tried it again, you know, ladies and gentlemen, he went, we're going to turn. And then that's it. So the person sitting next to me, who turned out to be, I think, the programme controller for, sitting in the row in front, who turned out to be, like, the programme controller for Capital Radio, said, oh, apparently the last time this happened, they gave everybody free £500 Marks and Spencer's vouchers. And the people on the next seats went, did you hear that? Apparently they... apparently we might get Marks and Spencer's vouchers. And so, like, there was, like, a ripple of that going up and down the thing. And then the captain came out of the cockpit and started addressing people, like, row by row, got to our row, and had to look at somebody. So I guess maybe he was intimidated. He didn't want to look at Keith Richards, so he looked at me. And he went, you may have noticed that we've slowed down dramatically. It's because we have a fuel leak. Our hydraulic fuel has leaked out. We're going to turn it. We're turning around, going back to London. We may or may not make it, but what I want to say to you is just enjoy the dessert. We'll be giving you dessert. And at this point, the guy in front turned around and, like, whispered at me, the vouchers! Mention the vouchers! Anyway, we got back to London. Obviously, I was thinking, God, if we crash for eternity, it's going to be... Because Keith Richards said, well, I don't care. Yeah, I don't care about this, but I tell you, he's going to be really pissed off. I won't hear anyone. Mick is at the front. Mick Jagger, I could see Mick Jagger's head pop up from the front of the plane and look for Keith. And found him and gave him a very sort of Mick Jagger wave. Like, because, Mick's going to be really pissed off. I don't care. I said to Keith, you said you've done everything. And he said, yeah, no, you're right. I've never flown over Greenland twice in one day. Anyway, we got back. I never got any vouchers. Got back.
That's an incredible story.
The end of the story is that we finally, after like two Concords and a night in New York, made it to Prince's house. Wow. And it was like a record launch, and there was somebody from the Sun there, or the News of the World. And he said, because I was telling everyone what had happened, and this journalist said, so I hear you were like sitting next to Keith Richards when Concorde, had technical problems. And I said, yeah. And he said, were you scared? And I said, I suppose I was a bit scared, yeah. And he said, was Keith Richards scared? And I said, no, Keith didn't seem very scared. Anyway, the next day, my wife phoned me and said, have you seen the paper? And it was, I was terrified, said passenger Ronson, but not Keith. Keith just knocked back another Jack Daniels with Coke and enjoyed the ride. So that's my, that's the closest I've got to a Beatles story.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
That is amazing.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I suppose if you're going to be in that situation, you're sitting next to someone who's immortal is probably, quite comforting.
I was going to ask about what your own musical career, because you, with Frank Sidebottom, you used to do Beatles songs, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. A lot of them. The Twist and Shout. Your early shirt. what other Beatles songs did you do? God. We did a lot of Queen songs and some Kylie songs, because Frank brought out an album called Frank Sidebottom Salutes the Magic of Freddie Mercury, Queen and Kylie Minogue. So we used to do most of the songs from that album.
Yeah.
Bum, so bum, cool. Bum, 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 bum. Frank! Yes! Oh! That was one of our songs.
God, that detail about the fact that he used to wear the clip on his nose and ended up actually deforming his nose.
He would, at the end of the show, he would take the head off and he was in agony. Like, this clip was, like, embedded in his nose. He'd have to, pull it out of his nose. Real pain.
That's mad. Oh, the thing I loved about Frank, I thought Frank was so amazing, but what I loved about it is you really capture just how the awkwardness of getting into music. You know, the bit where... Donald Gleason's going to show them his songs and he can't play any song all the way through. It's like, oh, I've got the one that goes a bit like this. And like, God, I've done that.
Well, yeah.
But you don't see, to see that so well captured on film.
It was so much fun. Because basically, the Donald Gleason character is based on me.
Yeah.
But the absolutely worst version of me that I could think of, venal, manipulative, utterly destructive without even realizing it. A little bit like the main character. I think it always strikes me as a funny coincidence that Donald Gleason played the lead in the movie The Little Stranger as well, because actually the John character in Frank and the character he plays in The Little Stranger are quite similar. These kind of very banal people who, through their banality, just like ruin everything. I just sat there for a few years and thought, what would the worst version of me do in this situation?
Yeah.
And then I just wrote it.
I think it's so brilliant because, I mean, the John character is kind of inclined towards pop, and he kind of wants to take it in a more poppy way, but they've got this experimentalism and...
Yes.
It's sort of in the film, the band is kind of almost naturally experimental in the way outsider art is,
I really wanted the band. This is why we diverged from Frank Sidebottom, because I just couldn't see how it would work if it was a comedy band, if the band didn't take themselves seriously. So I wanted the kind of Frank Sidebottom experience that I had as the keyboard player filtered through what if it hadn't been a comedy band, what if it had been a sort of mix of craft work, you know, who took themselves very, very seriously. And, you know, Captain Beefheart, that sort of culty thing where they're all off at a house together, like eating, they're only allowed to eat like a handful of beans a day. And then Daniel Johnson having a singer who's got, you know, serious mental health conditions. So, I was sort of trying to imagine what would have happened if the Frank Sidebottom Band had been that. That's why it wasn't Frank's music, was because I just thought it would be much funnier if the band took themselves extremely seriously. You know, one of my most enduring Beatles memories is I was about 14 or 15 and I got the White Album for my birthday and I just sort of lay in the dark listening to it over and over again. And I just remember, this is a really incredibly vivid memory from my childhood. I'm lying in bed with the lights off, listening to the White Album. My cat was asleep on my stomach and we were both like, you know, drifting in and out of sleep. And then when Helter Skelter came on, both me and the cat just like leapt into the air. Because whatever the song is on before Helter Skelter, it really lulls you. You know, it's, I can't remember what the song is before Helter Skelter, but the way
it might be Cry Baby Cry.
But the way that the song comes in, it's like a, you know, it's just like a kind of sawmill or something. And I just remember the two of us, me and the cat, just leaping and then both at the same time realising it's okay, it's just a song. And then we both relaxed again.
Sexy
great.
Sadie,
it's not Cry Baby. Sexy Sadie. I think Sexy Sadie really tails off. And which kind is why the kind of that comes in so so strongly.
Was that your is that still your number one record then?
The White Album. Actually, I've not heard it. I've not listened to it in years. More recently, I was never into the early Beatles, never into the pre-Rubber Soul Beatles. But because of reading the Craig Brown book, I've kind of gone back and watched a whole lot of old concert footage, like the footage that Ron Howard shot for 8 days a week and so on. So I'm beginning to get a good appreciation of the really early records now. Actually, if I think about it, the Beatles record I listen to most of all is probably Abbey Road, I'd say. That's where
that seems to be.
That's the key Paul is Dead text, isn't it? As well.
Do you think a lot of people settle into Abbey Road as being like their favourite Beatles album?
I think it's for me, it's Abbey Road, White Album, Revolver are probably the the classic three for me, I think.
Not Sgt. Pepper's.
No, I don't know why.
I think the Abbey Road maybe is one of those things that people grow to like more because it's Paul heavy. Going back to the, you know, that especially the sort of medley and stuff that people really love.
Have you ever read Waiting, speaking of Abbey Road, do you know the book Waiting for the Beatles?
No.
It's funny, it's like it's almost like I dreamed it because it's almost impossible to find online. It was written by one of the Apple Scruffs, this girl who came over from America to just like just sleep in a sleeping bag outside Paul's house, and she strongly intimates that George was sleeping with some of the Apple Scruffs. And they all get invited in to listen to the song Apple Scruffs that George recorded in tribute to them on All Things Must Pass. But it's a wonderful book. One of her friends, apparently, who Paul wrote. She came in through the bathroom window of It's a wonderful book, and it's surprising that it's just vanished from history. It could be a movie.
They all sing, they all got invited in to sing in Hey Jude, I think, as well. They did the na-na-nas.
The Apple Scruffs were there. I didn't know that.
So that was the fantastic John Ronson. What a lovely chat. What a generous man for joining us. That was a real highlight of my year, being able to talk to him. He really is a bit of a sort of literary hero of mine. I tried not to gush too much, and I tried not to talk about Randy Newman too much. That was fantastic.
It was great. I think the thing I love about John Ronson, he's just so curious, isn't he? And he's so interested in things and people, no matter how strange or unusual.
Yeah, it's, and that the sort of level of enthusiasm for pretty much everything is so infectious and
inspiring. I was listening to him talk and kept sort of forgetting I was doing a podcast. I kept thinking, am I just listening to a John Ronson podcast? And I was like, oh no, I've got to say something now.
Absolutely brilliant. I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. And you can go to give us a rating if you enjoyed that show on Apple Podcasts or Acast. 5-star ratings really do help the show. So if you have enjoyed it, go and give us a little visit and click on the old 5 stars. That would be lovely. Mm. So we'll be back next week with another show with a great guest, actually. One of my most enjoyable records we've done so far with Johnny White, Really, Really.
Johnny White's a very, very interesting comedian and musician. And we had a really, really interesting chat. We talked a kind of a lot about production stuff, ended up going down a kind of alleyway talking about Steve Albini for quite a bit. And he was very, very good at articulating the kind of childhood memories of the Beatles, like what he thought when, you know, those strange associations you'd have at the time when you first saw the Beatles. Those kind
and
of
how scary thing. It could be. And I've been thinking about that a lot recently because I forget that some of it was quite sort of dark and upsetting at a very young age.
Yeah. I didn't realise as well that, I mean, obviously this is the case, but like when a lot of Sergeant Peppery stuff came out, a lot of fans hated it as well.
Really?
I suppose
you would if you
stop writing weird
anything
songs
that radical,
things like that, you know.
Yeah. The Kid A of 1967.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So thank you so much for listening. If you got to this part, we've realised that about 25 to 30% of people listen to this little bit at the end. So if you are listening, you're definitely our favourite people. Mm-hmm. And maybe one day we'll tell you some secrets that the other normos won't hear. But thank you so much. We'll be back next week and have a nice week.
Cheers. Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.